Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Peter LaChapelle, professor of history at Nevada State College. And we're talking about his book, I'd Fight the World, A Political History of Old Time, Hillbilly, and Country Music. Pete, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this history.
It's a real pleasure to be on your show.
This is such a unique history. What drew you to this?
I think it's a couple of things. I grew up in Arizona, and this kind of music was obviously all around me. And to some degree, I kind of resisted it growing up and got into other things. And this is the 80s, so you know, you had kind of the punk and the new wave and other kinds of music kind of hitting the scene, hip-hop. And as I kind of, you know, grew up a little bit, went off to college, worked as a reporter, I got more and more interested in this kind of music. And I ended up, one of my first jobs was in Bakersfield, California, at the newspaper, The Californian. And there I ended up writing about country music and the Dust Bowl migration and all that great stuff. One of the things, though, kind of relating back to my hometown, I grew up in a town called Globe in Arizona, and it has this really strong, age-old, I almost feel like, populist history. And George P. Hunt, the first governor of Arizona, came from Globe, and he really kind of represented the mining unions and this kind of attempt to maybe foist control from, you know, more powerful interest ranchers, railroads, those sorts of banks, those sorts of industries during that era. And so I think it kind of came together. But wait a minute,
this is just not a history of the music, though. You've picked a very interesting sort of intersection, because this is where the music intersects with politics. And that's a really unique sort of road to go down.
Well, here's what happened is I worked on my first book, which was really mostly about the Dust Bowl migration and about people like Woody Guthrie and Merle Haggard. And of course, as I was doing this, because a lot of these folks had gone through the Depression and had seen the Dust Bowl, had seen the dust storms, and had, you know, a lot of them had experienced very severe poverty for a period of time, and there was a politics to their music, and you know, we might call it a cultural politics. What irked me as I was working on that book was, no one had actually studied the history of the political aspects of the country music genre. People had written about maybe what I more like cultural politics. So they had written about gender or race issues, these kinds of things. But, you know, I, like many country music scholars, you know, realized there was this larger history of all these figures. And I'd hear about them, and we all knew about them, but no one had kind of sat down and said, hey, you know, we need a book. I sort of wrote the book that I wished someone else had written.
You're critical, and I can see this having read the book, of sort of stereotypes that come out in movies like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, Nashville, and Facing the Crowd. Although, I have to say, after reading your book, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou sort of gets close to some points.
It's not bad. And I actually teach a whole semester-long class on Oh Brother, Where Art Thou.
I want to take that class.
We get to study all kinds. You know, we study the history of the South and to some degree the Midwest, and we look into John R. Brinkley, the quack doctor from Kansas, who used country music to try to get elected governor.
This is one of the figures from your book. That guy is crazy. That's the guy with the goat gland operations.
He essentially had kind of toyed around with different kinds of cons in his life, at least what his biographers talk about, and had finally settled on this idea that he could insert a portion of a goat gland into the male anatomy.
In other words, he's stitching goat testicles. He's grafting goat testicles onto yours.
Yeah.
I mean, let's say it what it is. That's what it was.
Yes. He was a pioneer in ED technology, I guess. I don't know. You know, and he, what's interesting about him is that, you know, I was kind of interested because this is history a lot of us who study the Midwest will know, you know, about his attempts at being, at trying to get elected governor, mostly
yeah.
So he could undercut, you know, a state regulatory boards that were trying to shut him down. But one of the things he did very smartly was he bought a radio station
That's right.
Milford, and then he also set up one eventually across the border in Mexico where he could kind of skirt the law. And he hired people, like one of the people I talk a great deal in the book about is Roy Faulkner,
right.
Who was really, he was an orphan who had, it's got this whole story. He lost an eye cutting wood, but when he was in his teens, he realized he could play guitar pretty well, and he started singing all the old 19th century, these really sentimental ballads or these ballads about lovers dying and all this kind of stuff. And then by the time the 20s hit, you had Vernon Dalhart and Robinson Carson, kind of two big cowboy singers making kind of little mini hits with their records. And that really influenced him. So he started performing this kind of music, and it was a big part of the show. And it also became his radio show on his Doc Brinkley's radio program. It also was, so he would perform at all of his rallies and was really popular and really got the crowd moving and had, you know, one estimate is that one of his rallies for the time in a small town was 20,000 people, which is just an enormous amount of people.
Well, let's talk about some generalities before we talk about specific politicians / musicians. You consider three types of country music politicians. One is the amateur musicians. Now, these are people who probably haven't cut a lot of records, but they play the fiddle or they play the banjo. And they'll play a little as they get up on the stage to make their speech, their stump. And the effect is, and you can sort of see this, they're regular folk. They're of the people by doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's professional musicians who use their celebrity to seek office. And then there's the non-musician politicians who employ country musicians. And it's a fascinating field that you consider, too, because they run the range, you know. Most of them are male, not all. All of them, I think, are white. But their politics can change incredibly. And the example I want you to talk about is Tom Watson, who was one of the earlier politicians. His politics did a 180.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. And
is there any explanation for why that happened? I mean,
well,
he was...
You know, I can speculate on it. One thing is I read his diaries, let me explain a little bit about the 180, first of all. You know, when he started out as a young politician, he was a Democrat, and he was using the fiddle really very effectively to get people
right.
to show up to his rallies. And in one account in his diaries, he talks about a place called Wrightsboro, and there he's fiddling for the crowd. And a friend accompanies him and plays what they call fiddlesticks, which is he's taking little sticks and kind of banging on actual Tom's fiddle while he's playing to add a little percussive element.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, well, who's playing with him? There's an African-American fiddler and an African-American percussionist playing tambourine. And he describes this in great detail, and I was like, wow, this is fascinating. And it, you know, and if you kind of go through eventually his story as he's running, this is really his first office, he appeals to the local Republican county council, which is African-American, essentially, to help him
right.
kind of win the election. And he starts out really kind of, and eventually he joins the populist movement of the, you know, the 1880s, 1890s, and becomes eventually a populist congressman. But he, you know, really urges African-Americans to get involved. He welcomes what are called the Colored Farmers Alliances into his movement, into his coalition. He makes speeches about how both blacks and whites are being kept down, especially poor blacks and poor whites, by the system of racial segregation. And he really is taking on the powers. And then later, there's kind of this long political wilderness, which is actually not a political wilderness. He's printing he becomes kind of a journalist after his congressional career. And at that point, I think he starts to realize that the South is changing. A lot of the state constitutions, you know, by 1900 are starting to really limit, in a more official way, black voting. And certainly Jim Crow started earlier, but, you know, it was becoming, he saw where the prevailing winds were blowing. And he may have harbored some of these prejudices as well. I mean, some of the research on him suggests that, you know, that though he had these very kind of racially egalitarian ideas in the early days, he still kind of believed that blacks and whites should inhabit separate kind of social spheres in some ways. So it might be a little bit of that, you know, I don't know. And you could get into the psychological element.
Was a wild change. I mean, it was
like... And then he became, you know, a major proponent of segregation.
Yeah, yeah.
He became quite a vocal anti-Semite and played kind of a leading role in the lynching of Leo Frank, who is a Jewish pencil factory superintendent.
He was also anti-Catholic, too.
He printed all these anti-Catholic tracts. So it's strange that he went this way. I think, you know, part of it is I can see that maybe that was the path of least resistance, but then again, he was leading the charge a lot of times. And I just, it's really hard to kind of wrap your brain around. I don't know if it's the traditional story of someone gets older and a lot more conservative, you know, and I guess you'd add on here a lot more racist and a lot more anti-Semitic.
It seems like it was more that he was more expedient. Like he knew what he had to do to stay elected. It was more like he was concerned about staying in office.
Yeah, yeah.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Peter LaChapelle, professor of history at Nevada State College. We're talking about his book. It's really interesting. I'd Fight the World, the Political History of Old-Time Hillbilly and Country Music. There are characters in your book that are, okay, Pappy O'Daniel, okay, from Texas.
Yeah, I have to admit a laugh when I hear that.
Okay, I know. It's like, and he was the voice, and this is a quote from your book, the voice, poet, and moral compass of the W. Lee O'Daniel in his Hillbilly Boys radio program. And so he was using music from his radio program to further his political career. And among them were the Light Crust Doughboys. I have to get a plug for the Light Crust Doughboys.
Yeah. Well, the Light Crust Doughboys are an excellent band, and I mean, it's if you have 78, they're prized possessions.
Well, Bob Wills, Bob Wills
and
was
then
in
later
the...
on. He forms his own. He leaves that and kind of forms his own band called the Hillbilly Boys.
That's right.
The ones that actually campaign with him, and it's actually two of his sons. One plays fiddle and one plays banjo.
But I love his radio program that had the catchphrase "Pass the biscuits, Pappy." But it's like it's like a classic. I mean, it's like a classic idea that you would use your sort of your radio celebrity to build up your politics. And that's another point that comes out in your book, is that these musical politicians used whatever they could of the technology that was new. They used radio. But then you also mentioned sound trucks. Sound trucks were really important. And how would they use sound trucks?
So, I mean, this is an interesting thing, and this goes back even maybe there's a big competition between Huey Long in Louisiana, and then the fellow we already talked about, John Brinkley in Kansas. They both in 1930 start using the sound trucks for their various campaigns, and the big, you know, they both claim they're the first American politicians to do so. It's kind of interesting. And, of course, there's a whole historical background to this, which is a couple of years later, Hitler uses these quite effectively to win elections in Germany. But
other than that,
aside, you know, I think it's kind of interesting. So Long was kind of using them to drum up a crowd, and he was, from what I can tell, he was playing jazz music on them and possibly, you know, kind of, I would say, like, jazzified Broadway songs and things like that. On the other hand, what Brinkley did was he would use them, set them up, you know, at his rallies, and then have various performers, including Roy Faulkner, who I talked about a little bit earlier, and he had a whole group of performers that would get up and put on these great shows, and it would kind of, you know, warm up the crowd, and it reached, you know, a lot more people than the traditional kind of, you know, by word of voice and maybe announcement in the local newspaper sort of rally did. You know, we were reaching a lot more people. And wow. They would use, eventually, these, you know, people like I talk about in Alabama, you have politicians, you know, using sound trucks to, they kind of canvass a town and they're playing, you know, they're both announcing and playing music, right, inviting people to a rally. And Big Jim Folsom, one of the figures I talk about, and he's a very colorful character too, you know, was really effective at doing this, and he used his band, the Strawberry Pickers, to warm the crowds up, get people excited before he would come out and speak.
I want to cram in a lot more information before we run out of time.
Okay.
there's a thing you call, it's tough to say if there's anything the same about all these varied politicians, but there is some points that you talk about in the book about the hillbilly style of politics. And one of them, first of all, they all relish their outsider status, right?
This is true. And in a lot of ways, they were. You know, Pappy O'Daniel, the closest thing he had in terms of politics was that he was involved in the local Chamber of Commerce in Fort Worth. But he really didn't, you know, he didn't at least appear to be, you know, kind of moving in towards those kinds of positions that would open you up for statewide office. And then he ran against a former state attorney general and a couple of mayors who were quite popular. And he really was the outsider in some ways, but, you know, he used his radio broadcast, his familiarity with the average Texan to really, you know, amplify his political campaign. And, you know, there's I'm not going to get this quote exactly right, but there's a commentator who says, you know, every day at 12:15 sharp, the state of Texas stood still, listening to the dulcet voice of Pappy O'Daniel in his hillbilly boys. Or if it was an earlier one, it might have been the light crust doughboys, you know, because that was eventually. So, you know, he really had this impact. And the truth, the funny thing about this was, working on my first book, I interviewed people who talked about that 12:15.
Wow.
They remembered it very clearly. And, you know, Seth McKay, who was a historian and kind of a political scientist back in the 40s, he went back about 10 years and looked at this election. And he went county by county and showed that essentially the only counties that didn't really vote for O'Daniel were the ones that were out of reach of his radio network.
Wow. Well, let's get back to politics.
Yes.
There was an importance for pension politics. What is that?
So, you know, the pension movement, really, this is the way that we talked about in this country retirement before, you know, we kind of had our modern day, you know, idea of Medicare and, you know, those sorts of Social Security. And there was a lot of pressure. This goes back to the 1890s, but by the 19-teens, 1920s, 1930s, Americans are really getting interested. There's a lot of pressure to offer pensions for people. And there's obviously on some level some stirrings in Congress about this, but Congress has taken a while to do it and isn't really till the New Deal that the Social Security Act is passed. So it kind of ends up being kind of a state-by-state movement. And in California, there was a fellow, a doctor by the name of Francis Townsend, who started a movement that eventually kind of moved more nationally. Huey Long, from time to time in Louisiana, was talking about starting pensions, and he did start a state pension. And so a lot of these southern states were slowly enacting legislation that would provide maybe $30 a month for those over 65, and it would come out of state coffers. It would be managed by, you know, an appointed official. And what's strange is that, and it kind of makes sense, a lot of these country music politicians, you know, and I talk, especially in the 30s and early 40s, there's three figures that are probably, so Pappy's one of them, Roy Acuff, who back then people would call the king of country music because of his prominence on as a fiddler and as a performer on the Grand Ole Opry, the most popular, you know, eventually the most popular country barn dance in the country. And then also Jimmy Davis, who was a recording star, probably most well known for popularizing the song "You Are My Sunshine," you know, and that's certainly something that carries on today. You know, I just heard a kindergarten class the other day singing "You Are My Sunshine." They all three of these figures. He was in Louisiana, and he eventually gets elected governor. All three of them really pushed the pension politics as part of their movement, and it's interesting. Pappy was really good at this. He would bring in tell stories about poor old mom at home.
Right, yeah.
And then his band would draw from the country music tradition. And, you know, back in the 20s and 30s, we still have this today to some degree in modern country music, but there were all these songs, just song after song after song about the poor folks at home, and some of these even going back to Stephen Foster in the 19th century. And these were really, I mean, they made a large portion of what I would consider the hillbilly or country music repertoire at the time. So it totally made sense that they would adopt this kind of style of politics. And then some of them also took on the big political machines in their state.
Well, so, especially urban ones.
Yeah. And there's certainly this kind of, you know, occasionally there's an anti-urban element to the country. And there still certainly is today, I suppose.
Right, right.
Even though, you know, with bro country, maybe you have songs set in suburban parking lots, which is kind of there's always these contradictions. But going back to the political machines, Huey Long was the target, or his regime. By that point, he had been 1930 assassinated. But when Jimmy Davis, you know, ran for governor, he really ran on an anti-Long ticket, and his goal was to, he argued, you know, to really bring efficiency back to the state, to bring honesty back to what he saw as the Long machine's corrupt, you know, governance. And he would emphasize some of these themes and kind of reach out to voters. And oh, he's fascinating in how he reaches out to the French-speaking parts of Louisiana by, you know, he realized he wasn't really getting people to show up at his rallies in these areas. So he would go on the radio and start playing more of his songs and doing less talking. And then eventually he realized, well, I need to add some, you know, Cajun songs to my repertoire.
Wow.
And once he did that, he added Joe Lebon.
Yeah.
Once he did that, the crowd suddenly came out.
So. Now, we're going to run out of time here, man. And I want to make sure, there's so many people I wanted to mention. And there was a senator, Glenn Taylor, that I wish I could read an entire book about. because he's such a fascinating guy. Yeah. He's from Idaho, right? Oregon. He was born in Portland, Oregon. And you mentioned this film of him as he goes to the, he pulls out a banjo and starts playing Home on the Range as he's going to his job in Congress.
Yeah, it's crazy. And actually, if you look, I think on YouTube, I think you can find it. I actually got a copy of the original newsreel that it was on, and I actually played it for an audience a couple of weeks ago. I gave a talk here in town, and it was a big hit. You know, it's essentially him.
His family.
His first day in the Senate.
Yeah.
Him and his family. They're all dressed to the nines, you know, kind of in they all seem to be wearing black for some reason. Maybe that's a very formal color there for the, you know, inauguration or for the, what do you call it, that when the Senate takes their oath.
Right.
And they kind of make their way across the steps. Actually, it's the Supreme Court steps, but the view for the press that's gathered is really of the, you know, of the Capitol building. And they sit down, and he makes a little speech about the fact that there isn't really very much housing in Washington, D.C.,
right.
And this is right after World War II, and that it would be a good idea maybe to build some barracks for some of the poorer senators.
Wow.
Such as he. And then they start singing a version of Home on the Range that essentially changes the word slightly to
right.
ask for a nice home for the family.
And he's playing a banjo. He's playing a banjo.
And he's playing banjo with his wife and his two sons, A-Rod, who I actually interviewed, and PJ, his youngest son, who's really kind of just a little toddler.
He was definitely left of center.
And
he really did things like push for civil rights. But then he became sort of fascinated, and this sounds like something out of a film, by the writings of the razor magnet King Camp Gillette and his utopian writings. And that sort of essentially it's like, first of all, I love the fact that there's a razor magnet, but it sort of ruined his, because people started to, in the press started, eventually they called him a communist. But then they, you know, they would say he was a hammy humorist, a lightweight thinker and stuff like that. And he just sort of didn't get any traction.
Yeah, it did. It hurt him. He actually talked about this earlier in his career, and then he kind of, stopped talking about it and got more professional. And he would, and of course, even though he's more professional, he was doing these equestrian rides throughout Idaho to raise interest in his campaign, which is really non-traditional. He would wear a suit sometimes, though. That was his attempt to be more non-traditional. He just really interesting guy. But yeah, he at least as an early candidate, and he ran many times and did not get elected. he would talk about Gillette, and Gillette, the founder of the company we know as Gillette, really was a socialist who kind of imagined we would eventually build a all world corporation, and that this would allow individuals to be shareholders in the corporation in kind of this strange combination of socialism and capitalism.
Okay,
kind of a utopian.
Peter,
world.
we're going to have to stop there because we're completely out of time, and we have barely talked about this book because there's so much crammed in here that's fascinating. My guest tonight has been Peter LaChapelle, professor of history at Nevada State College, and we're talking about his book. I strongly recommend it. It's a book about a subject that you've probably never thought about, and that's I'd Fight the World, a political history of old time, hillbilly, and country music. Peter, thanks so much for giving me your time.
Thanks for having me on.
I feel like I should pull out a banjo as we say goodbye. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.